Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here.
And Mike Cosentino over here.
Only here. The dog ate my homework, folks.
Yeah.
So it's not nearly as
Yeah, he walks in the studio. Very late.
Actually, I was on vacation. I did all my work on my laptop, and I pulled the plug out of it, or the doggy pulled the plug out of it. Somebody did, and my laptop wouldn't load up. So there was all my notes and all my research. So I also got up an hour later because I'm on California time rather than time. But let's talk today about income inequality.
Yeah.
What is income inequality?
And why does anybody care? Why should anybody care about it?
Well, there's a whole lot of different reasons. Income inequality is about the difference between the amount of income of the very wealthy and basically the middle class.
The rest of us.
The rest of us. We're not really focusing on the poor, but that's there too. We're focusing on the decline of the middle class standard of living. Actually, middle class standard of living has been going up because there's been a big increase in the wealth of the country from, say, the 1960s until the 2000s. So there's been this huge increase in wealth. There's a huge increase in productivity. It's the distribution of the results of that constitute wealth inequality and income inequality. So wealth is the total amount of stuff that people own. The top 1%, it's all their stocks and bonds and so forth and so on. There's two ways to measure wealth. One is you include houses in, because for middle class people, their main investment is really their homes. If they own a home, that's pretty much a huge portion of their wealth. And either way you measure it, wealth is getting more and more maldistributed. If you think that it's wrong to have the top have so much and the rest of us have much less. There did an interesting study, and I forgot, I think the guys were at NYU, and instead of asking what the wealth distribution was in the United States, they went and asked a whole bunch of people, what do you think it is? What do you think the percentage of the top 20% own of the United States, own of everything in the whole country? What percentage do you think? And they asked men, women, young, old, Republicans, and Democrats, and pretty much everybody had the same answer. And the answer was the top 20% owned 60% of the country. That's a little shocker. Top 20% owned 60%, three times as much as they're constituted by population. What's interesting is that the top 20%, Mike, own 85% of everything in the country.
People's perceptions were what you thought it would be. It was, but it's way worse than that. You know, it's way, way, way worse than that. The graph that we're going to sit here and talk about a visual and it doesn't, I'm not sure that but the graph now for the richest 1%. It used to be 50 years ago that the graph at least looked like people thought it did.
That's
now
right.
The graph for the richest 1% would need like 6 pages. They tell you we would need 6 pages to put this 1% on the graph, and then the rest of us would be down here. That's the difference. And why does it? Well, who gives a fat rat's behind that? You know, okay, there's poor people. I've been poor people. I mean, you see it on. You know, Jesus said there always be the poor. Okay, there's poor people. But one of the things, one of the problems with income inequality, Mr. Stephen, Mr. Guy in California here, is that poor people, or even middle-class people who are struggling all the time, don't participate politically. You hear it all the time that people are backing off of politics or have backed off of politics, and democracy doesn't work that way. So they don't become involved. They become less involved because they don't have any money. Money either becomes they don't have money. We all know the whole American political system works on donations. It works on a financial thing. So they're not able to participate that way.
And that's what Mike's talking about, is the connection between wealth and power. And you can see that in some of these huge contributions to political campaigns that you can transform wealth, huge amount of income into political power by donating to political parties, by donating to individuals, by putting attack ads on the television.
Yeah, we
the
are
Koch brothers are a great example.
We are suffering from $800,000 worth of attack ads on acupuncture right now.
Right. And so the worst thing that politically that the Supreme Court did was to say that basically corporations were people, and this allows all of this money pouring into politics. Mike and I have done several shows on dark money pouring into politics to be hidden. The old argument was, well, at least we know it's these five rich guys who are giving all the money, so we can counterbalance that. And to some extent, that does have some truth to it. But what happened with that decision is that the money, the sources of the ads, and you're talking about ads against our congresswoman, it's all front groups.
Right.
I mean, it's all front groups with really nice sounding
names. Americans for Prosperity.
But to get back to income inequality and what's happening in the country is that, and I have a graph, Mike's talking about not being able to see a graph, but productivity has been going up at a fairly steep angle. The productivity is normally after World War II, between World War II and the 20s, as productivity went up, the amount of goods produced per worker and stuff, the amount of income distributed to people was fairly even. The rich got their share, and the middle class got another share. And what's happened now is that for several decades, productivity has been going up, but wages for middle class people have been stagnant. And, you know, it's been worse for men than women. Men started out in a much better position than women in terms of wages. Their wages have stagnated more than women as women have entered the workforce and had more jobs available. So the picture of the guy the man of the house earning enough money to support his wife, his children, buy a car and a house has long disappeared.
Let me throw in a statistic here. And this is a PolitiFact that did a great job on a guy named Ian Bremmer compares the big gains of the top 1% to the stagnation of the bottom 99%. From 2009 to 2013, the top 1% saw their incomes increase 31.4%. Say that again. 2009 to 2013, recent figures, the top 1% saw their incomes increase 31.4%. While for the bottom 99%, saw their incomes go up 0.4%.
Let's take it even, folks, over a very much longer interval, a greater amount of time. And a study by the Congressional Budget Office says that in between, what's the date, 1979 and 2007, the top 1% saw their income increase 275% over that huge period of time. The rest of us saw our income increase 40%. This is as the country is getting wealthier and wealthier, and productivity has been going up. It's not like productivity has collapsed. It's been up and down, but largely moving almost like a triangle upward.
And this is, everybody's talking about this now, and this is, you know, one way to look at it is the statistics are thrown at you and the perceptions and that kind of thing. But the other, what used to happen, I think, and this is one of those things I can hear people, listeners now just say, everybody's got an opinion on this one, but that it would even out because of taxes, that pre-tax, and it used to be that any politician that used the word redistribution of wealth, that was his last day in politics. He'd be gone or she'd be gone. But right now we have headlines that are talking about the upward redistribution of wealth. Steve's talking about productivity. The benefit of that productivity is not going to the people who are being productive. It's going to the top and you say 20%, and that's, it's going, certainly going to the top anyway.
And it's going, the further you go up the ladder, the more shocking percentage it is. So the top 20% is not quite as shocking a stat as the top 1%.
The top 1%.
And the top 1% of the 1%, I mean, there's like 480 people own, I don't know, as much as pretty much the rest of us put together.
Exactly.
So the higher you go up this, the more the distortion. And I think what Mike was talking about earlier is power and money, all this money being distributed up, what is the effect on a democracy? In other words, if you have a few wealthy people with the money can buy all these ads, and you got the rest of us.
Right. Well, that and there's two things I want. There's the 53, I heard it phrased the other day called the $53 trillion question. Right now there's $53 trillion being held offshore by the 1%. Now, what they do with that $53 trillion, whether they bring it in and invest it in jobs, whether Congress ever stops harassing Obama long enough to do a jobs bill, to do one stinking jobs bill, and maybe and that to see some of that $53 trillion come back in, that's really for some people the determiner on where the American economy is going to go. That money held offshore is
and I guess for folks like Mike and I, it was very frustrating for the president to wait 5 years before he mentions income inequality, like he suddenly discovered it. Like most Democrats, most people researching this haven't been worried about this for the entire time he's been in office.
Yeah,
he's talking about this deficit most of the time, and he didn't talk enough about unemployment, and he didn't talk enough about income inequality. He didn't even address the issue until fairly recently.
The fact
recently.
That our guy doesn't know how to use the bully puppet of the presidency is another... like another six shows, but my other problem as a dyed-in-the-wool bleeding-heart liberal is that the other statistic I want to throw at you that the economists like to use is that our safety net at 0.15% is the smallest of any of the European, any of the developed countries. And most people interpret that as America's safety net is not only not as deep as it's needed to be, it's not as broad. It's not just how much you spend, it's what you spend it on at that level. So we only take care of the poorest of the poor. I'm going to make a case later on for universal programs, and I have one author I looked at that, people want to throw rich people off of Social Security. Well, one of the things that keeps these programs popular in other parts of the world is that they are universal. Progressives like me and Steve, we often, it rubs us the wrong way to see people that don't need it getting because of.
Let me interrupt you here, Mike, and because I wanted to read something by a guy who knows how to use the bully pulpit. Let's see, his name is Pope Francis.
Yes, he does.
And in a recent encyclical, he said, "As long as the problems of the poor are not radically resolved by rejecting the absolute autonomy of markets and financial speculation, and by attacking the structural causes of inequality, no solution will be found to the world's problem, or for that matter, to any problem." There's a guy who knows how to use the bully pulpit.
That's right. He does. He certainly does. And really, in the time he's been in office, he has directed more attention to worldwide poverty and its political impact. It's one thing, when there's a bunch of poor people in Africa or in the Middle East, that's too bad. Give me another bowl of popcorn and turn the TV on.
The other thing Mike was talking about is wealth is the most maldistributed in the United States of any industrialized wealthy country, except in about 2000 when they did a study, Switzerland was above us. So it ran Switzerland, the United States, Denmark, and this is the lower on the list, the more equality there is in the country, France, Sweden, you know, so forth and so on. So we're at the top. The very top of maldistribution or income inequality. We're at the top, and the other thing that we should talk about later on, Mike, is that this affects upward mobility of people. And the United States, our entire history, we prided ourselves on upward mobility. Part of this concentration of wealth among the top people seems to have been accompanied, if not caused, by an increase.
Go ahead, Mike. It is the most unequal country in the rich world, and thus we're becoming more so. We're growing apart. I think one of the things both of us are trying to say this morning is money is money, but what happens is we grow apart as a society. And now there's been a barrage of really recent, except for the one I gave, of statistics that say things that are sounding a little bit better for the middle class, but
what happens in a recession? It is tend to be a little bit of a leveling factor. And so during the Great Recession, before the Great Recession, there's a huge income inequality. The income inequality in the United States now is equal to 1922. So the whole the Great Depression, World War II, the economic boom after the war has been erased, and we're back to a pre-war situation, pre-World War II situation in terms of the distribution of wealth. And, you know, 1922 is...
Exactly.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a dyed-in-the-wool egalitarian to worry about this trend, and I'm quoting some authors here. Although some degree of inequality is good for an economy. It creates incentives to work hard. It creates incentive to take some risk. The recent concentration of income gains among the most affluent is both politically dangerous and economically dangerous. It's a two-edged sword here for sure. The political worry is a descent into angry populism, kind of where I'm at right now. We can call me an angry populist.
I think it's a good point, Mike, and none of us are in favor. I don't really actually have met anybody in favor of absolute equality, because there is, in terms of income, because there are different needs, and there's also, you do want to motivate people to innovate and create things and to invest in the economy. That's one way to keep it growing. Although, you know, this talk about job creators is very distorted. And, you know, a lot of the people who are investing money startups and so forth and so on are large pension funds. It's not a person. It's a whole bunch of people in the public sector who are putting their money in, their money managers are trying to make more money for their pension plans. What you got, Mike?
The biggest, as far as that, the biggest loser here are young people, I think. We're eating our young. This is not a good thing for a society. We're consuming our young in our economy. It is time to, if there's going to be to use the banned term, a redistribution, there needs to be some redistribution of wealth from tax subsidies. If you're giving tax subsidies to the rich, I mean, when Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, all these guys are begging, please, I should be paying more taxes. And these guys that are these sane rich guys, I say we need to cut, and yet they're getting tax cuts and tax subsidies. And so this is a no-brainer. Stop giving the tax subsidies to the rich and invest in the young. It's that simple. The education, Pell Grants, The
question, Mike, is why is this happening?
Right.
And there's whole bunches of different answers that we can talk about.
Give me one.
Why? A taxation.
Okay.
They cut the taxes on the wealthy. The wealthy keeping more of their money. They're taking the money and they're investing it because they don't have anything else to do with it. Once you get five yachts, you're
sort of done.
Hold your
thought. Don't forget where you're going. I saw a great cartoon with a bust of Ronald Reagan with a grin on his face. And it was a statue of him back somewhere. And he had an icicle hanging out one of his nostrils. And they talked about this is the trickle-down theory. This is the trickle-down theory at work. And this is the only way it's ever worked, is this stuff running out his nose.
Yeah, there's two ways to measure income. It's before taxes and after taxes. And there's two ways to measure wealth, whether you include houses in or not. So these are complex issues, and but it's fairly standardized measures of what income inequality looks like. It's called the Gini or G-I-N-I index, and it's used worldwide by pretty much everybody. And there are different estimates, folks. The CIA has one estimate of income inequality in countries, and the United Nations has another, and some private, public interest groups, have still other measures, but it's pretty close. And in 2010, so this is fairly reasonable statistic, the top 1% had a mean household income of $1,318,000. Now that's not the top 1% of the 1% who make hundreds of millions of dollars, who even they have a disproportionate amount of the 1% money. And they have a household wealth of $15 million. Okay. Without the home. In other words, they have on average $15 million of investments that don't include their house. The bottom 40% have a mean household income of $17,000. This is 2010. $17,300. They have a mean household worth of a minus $14,800. The bottom half is going in debt to try to keep their living standards up.
Yeah.
And you can see it in these statistics. It's not the things that you see when you look around, folks, about how people are struggling to stay even and how people are working two or three jobs. You may not like statistics. You may be skeptical of them, and there's good reasons to be, but they're reflected in the statistics. The things that you're seeing, the things that you've seen, particularly for older folks in your lifetime, it's not an illusion.
Yeah, let's take the perspective here is that most of us, working a quote-unquote middle-class job, teachers, lawyers, cops, might make $2 million in their lifetime. As far as the salary goes. And so when we're throwing around, people making $1.3 million a year as an average for a class, that's the difference. That's the amount of cash we're talking about here. I want to get into kind of more of a controversy. There's poverty, and poverty is one of those really difficult things to zero in on. What is poverty? Well, I don't know. I think I'm poor, but, turn on the TV and pass the popcorn. It's that kind of poor. But then there's poverty measured by, I was listening on NPR this morning, how many onions and potatoes can you put in your basket? Can you purchase enough calories and enough vitamins to keep you and your family alive?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's people who are stingy and don't want to spend any money or showing up at the food bank. This is a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage. Those people are not standing in line to get stuff if they have plenty of food. They're standing in line because they can't make their income month to month to cover their expenses without reducing one expense, and one expense is food.
And that's a good thing to talk about, and that's depressing, and we probably should talk about it. But what the point of this morning's story was, he quoted Adam Smith that in the 1800s.
Wealth of Nations.
A man considered himself poor if he couldn't have a linen shirt. Well, the Greeks and the Romans didn't run around in linen shirts, and many of them didn't consider themselves poor. And what he was saying is that the standard of poverty changes.
Yes.
So if not having a cell phone I can't think of anyone who would not consider not having a cell phone. Try to follow my negatives on that one. Not having a cell phone would be considered poverty.
That's right. What you were talking about earlier is that the wealth of the country has increased in the last 40, 50 years. And so what it means to be poor now, for the very poor, has not changed much. But for pretty much everybody else, the marginally poor are better off than they would have been. And the war on poverty, people say, well, the war on poverty didn't work because we still have poverty. But recent studies show that what the war on poverty did was cut the poverty rate by about 10%. It would be much worse. I think it's about 24% now. And it would have been much worse if it'd been no war on poverty. War on poverty is fairly simple stuff, unemployment insurance. But what it really was, what was the core of it was, you know, Medicare, Medicaid,
Social Security,
improvements in Social Security.
Food stamps.
Social Security didn't start out that great, and then food stamps. And that provides a cushion.
Millions and millions, I'm going to say it the way Rene Montaigne, millions of people's lives got better. People who were living on the edge of hope, and I'm quoting one of the mucky mucks, millions of Americans lived on the edge of hope in 1965. Then we get Social Security and food stamps. Millions of people's lives get better. Now in 2014, we have millions of people, 46 million to be exact, living on the edge of hope. And it's not that those programs didn't work, that 46 million would be 86 million if it wasn't for those programs.
Well, it would certainly be larger. And so once they've started looking at things carefully, they can see what the programs do. There are a lot of different reasons, and I'm going to read some out, Mike, that they say that this income inequality is getting worse and worse. And look at this paper here in front of me. And there's a whole list of them. Skill-based technological chains. U.S. Steel employed a whole lot of people given the size of the company compared to Yahoo.
Yeah.
There's less high-paying jobs out there. There's some very, very good-paying jobs, but they don't need nearly as many people. And this is one thing we should talk about on another show: is how much, what's the full impact of of skill-based technological change to cut in the number of jobs?
Right.
They're not being generated. Education. The more educated you are, the better your economic situation, and that's gotten more. It's increased over the last few decades. Globalization helped undercut unions, helped undercut wages in the United States. If you own a company, and to be fair to say an owners of a company, if you own a company and in the United States, the people work for you making living wage, and if you can make the same thing, and now I guess the country of choice are Bangladesh and Vietnam because China's getting expensive, you can outcompete. So your neighbor who's trying to do everything in the U.S. has a problem. Yeah. So the globalization has had a vast amount of impact. Immigration, people say, well, there's people coming into the country who are willing to work for less. And in response to that, well, they're doing a lot of jobs that, you know, nobody else wants to do. But there's immigration. The other thing is that, of course, immigrants bring a tremendous amount of wealth into the country when they come here, a tremendous amount of energy. And our country's kind of been based on that.
Statistic, $10.6 billion paid in taxes by undocumented immigrants. $10.6 billion paid in taxes last year.
Political, normative, and institutional changes. This is one of the things in Wikipedia. What they're saying is it's not Republican, Democrats. There's been a vast argument and denunciation of unions. And unions, and when everybody's looking at it now, pretty much unions kept wages higher here.
Absolutely.
And produced a large, stronger middle class. And it was much stronger for men than women. Yeah. Because the men were in the majority of in all the unionized jobs.
Breadwinners, yeah.
With the collapse of the union movement, there's been a huge drop in the increase in men's wages particularly.
I like to say there's nothing more American than a union. Let me say it again. There's nothing more American than union. An organization that fights for the little guy, an organization that takes on the at least tries to work, to worry about working conditions, worry about wages, worry about benefits of workers, that's an American ideal. So I don't know that, I just believe that the rich were so very successful, just like they were with trickle down theory. They were convinced, they still have a large segment of the American population convinced that it's their fault that they don't have money, and that if we keep giving tax breaks to the wealthy, then we are somehow going to, it's going to benefit us.
And Wikipedia calls that non-party political action. And that's convincing people, not just the Republican Party, but basically the guys who have all the money send out huge propaganda machines to convince people that that's just fine. Right?
That's right.
And it's efficient. It's everybody to trickle down. You're going to get this stuff. So that there's, and one of the things that it's kind of interesting, it's kind of interesting point is that this distribution of wealth has made lobbying more efficient. Not only have they spent billions more dollars on it, but it's made it more efficient. They can micro-lobby Congress.
Right.
And so the micro-lobbying of Congress is done very largely by the very wealthy and the institutions they control. And so then they're able to stack the deck better than they used to be able to stack the deck, say, in 1955 when there was a lot of countervailing power. There's also a variation, depending on who's president, of the distribution of income. So under Truman, it's much better than under, you know, Eisenhower and so forth and so on. So there is a difference in the political party. Republicans, I frankly believe in upward distribution of wealth, I think. Or they believe that it won't happen despite the facts. What do you think, Mike? Do you think they believe it's just not happening, or do they think it's a good thing?
They think it's a good thing. They are the true believers of the message, of the erroneous message that the richer
job creators.
Yeah, the job creators, right?
Job creators.
Right, right. And the only driver of the economy, as we keep seeing in quote after quote, is a middle class with money. The only driver of a good economy is a middle class with money, is buying power of the proletariat. I'm sorry, I threw that in there. But the idea is that,
We're the 47% that are just sort of worthless guys sponging off the government because I've collected unemployment during my life.
Well, but that 47% drives the economy. With those 47% with money.
So one of the things that's happened is, aside from the political parties, is the wealthy have gotten more efficient in producing their producing the results they want. As the wealth has gotten concentrated, they've been able to convince people everything is just fine, what Mike was talking about there. What else? Well, there's a long list of what things. I don't think we really truly understand all the things that are this inequality. So just to restate it a little bit, productivity has been going up. The wealth of the country has been going up. More and more of that wealth, that income, is going to the top of the top, the 1% of the 1%. And less of it has been going to everybody else. So the question, folks, about income inequality is, why is this occurring, and is it a bad thing? There's an interesting article by Stiglitz, who's won the Nobel Prize in economics. And what he says is, most people think there's a difference between the sluggish recovery of the American economy from the Great Recession here, and they don't realize that that's connected with income inequality. The lack of spending power on the broad middle class of people, as their wealth and income doesn't increase, has made for a very, very sluggish economy. And from the point of view of the Democrats, Republicans have systematically done everything they could to keep any of the stimulus that would have gotten us out of this recession faster from happening. And so we've been dependent on the Fed, which is a kind of an innovation to keep interest rates very low. So we've talked about a lot of these things, you know, folks, like, for example, interest rates. And And just to go back over it, you know, when the economy's overheated, the Fed, the Federal, increases the interest rates that go to banks, and then banks increase the business rates that go to you. It's harder to borrow money, and the economy slows down so that you don't have a lot of inflation. When the economy is deeply, deeply depressed, when it's really on the bottom, then you stimulate the economy by having very low interest rates. And that's what's happening now. And our latest job figures, which came out, what, just a couple of weeks ago, are very, very sluggish and very, very slow. Right. And so the Fed was talking about increasing the interest rate, which slows the economy. People think, well, maybe they'll think that over again, because the recovery in terms of creating jobs has not been that good.
No. No, it hasn't. And one of the things that was the some left people would like to see is investment in the young. That's a universal thing. I'm not going to label that as right or left. These guys, Cowan and Mason, a guy named Tyler Cowan at George Mason University thinks the population will soon be divided into two groups. You were talking about technology earlier. You said the population is going to be divided into two groups. Those who are good at working with intelligent machines, and those who can be replaced by those intelligent machines. The former will prosper, and the latter will just play a lot of video games, and which so far, except for Ender's Game, not prosper.
I think what Mike's asking, or my take on what Mike's asking is, are we really going to need the whole population working in the far future? We're going to be hit over the next few years, this is my guess, folks, personal guess, by a tremendous increase in the different kinds of work done by artificial intelligence devices, call them robots, whatever you want to call them. We're going to really need everybody working, what are the deeper implications of this? Statistically now, automation has not really taken that many jobs. But I'm not sure that you don't have most of these things happen not in kind of a straight line, but almost like a quantum jump. You're here and you move up, and then suddenly something happens. You can call it a tipping point. Something happens and you begin to go over the edge in the number of jobs. And what do you do in a situation where everybody is not needed to work, or not needed to work their whole lives? Do you cut down the work week and spread the jobs out? Well, do you ask people to retire earlier?
Well, that said, politics doesn't have all the answers. But it, sometimes through taxation, and once again, the left will say, well, just tax the rich more and everything will be fine. Well, that's not true. There's two things. We may need to have a higher margin where the money is, a higher tax margin. But the other point would be to invest in early childhood education. And the earlier you invest in those things, then the more likely you are to get those people who that are indispensable, are more indispensable than those intelligent machines are indispensable. All those jobs that I remember at U.S. Steel, at Bethlehem, none of them exist anymore. All those well-paying middle-class jobs they all don't exist. When you watch that welder bounce around on those videotapes, bounce around that car and make every weld in, 18 seconds that it took, my cousin Frankie, 14 days to finish the welds on, I can go on and on. I mean, all those jobs are gone. So, it makes sense to take the money that's there, the redistribution of wealth, the downward redistribution of wealth.
So you're questioning, you're saying like it's not just enough to raise taxes so that they're fairer on the top 1%. It's how you invest the money in the country from the increased taxation. And you're saying the best way to invest it is early childhood education, education in general?
Education in general, early childhood education specifically is certainly one good place for it. Let's start investing in the young. It gives all of us a better shot at a better life and a stronger country and a more functioning democracy than we have now.
So despite what you've heard, folks, and you'll hear it over and over again, despite what you've heard, the country was growing at the faster rate when the taxes on the wealthy were higher. most of these hedge fund managers, first, they're in a very taxed advantage situation we won't go into, where they're the reason Romney doesn't pay any taxes compared to us is because of the way that they calculate the income from hedge fund managers. They calculate it as investment rather than income, so it's not taxed like the rest of the things are taxed. I don't know where we're going.
We must mention Robert Rice and Inequality for All.
Yeah.
A movie shown over here at the Mary Fisher Theater within the last month or so, and a movie that's going to be shown at the Sedona Library. We do want to, you can buy it online, and I believe he's donated the money. Robert Rice right now is, at least for some of us, an eloquent. But if you don't like Robert Rice because he worked in Democratic administrations in the United States in the past, fine. You can go anywhere you want and get tons of inequality figures. You can go to The Economist, a well-respected British newspaper.
The information on inequality goes fairly far across the spectrum. I mean,
absolutely.
I think if you go to some of the really right-wing publications, they'll tell you what income inequality, or they'll say, oh, income inequality is a good thing. That's why we have a dynamic country.
That's why we're better than everybody else.
And they'll deny any of the impact of income inequality. They'll deny the impact of it in terms of social mobility. Social mobility has been going down in the United States, not up. Our social mobility in the United States is worse than most of these aging, you know, in our point of view, European countries.
And once again, it doesn't take statistics to see this. Look around at your own families. Which of them have, which of your children, which of your relatives are doing better than you did? You know, Mr. Retired man or woman in Sedona, which of your children are doing better than you? How many of them? How about your cousin? I think that you'll find that it's not the way it was when we were younger.
You have to look at your situation, but you also have to look at your parents and your grandparents and your children's situation. So if you're not benefiting by Social Security, look at your mom or your grandmother.
And that was an American axiom. The next generation would do better than the previous.
If you look out, and not just at yourself, but at your family and at your friends and what's happening to them, you get a much more accurate and broader picture of what's going on.
I want to give a shout out to, speaking of people that are doing the activist role here, we have people down at the Arizona Legislature. Today is the opening day. This is kind of an appropriate show for today. Opening day of the Arizona Legislature. We have
who love income inequality.
Who
have a tax system designed to make sure that there's income inequality, folks.
Exactly.
Sales taxes are regressive, and that's how we finance everything in Arizona.
We do live in what I consider a low-tax state. Other people might consider a medium-tax state. But and we have the services and the poor education, at least the poorly funded education program to prove it. We have all sorts of people down. We have women down at the ledge. Planned Parenthood is down there today. The attack on women's reproductive rights, which I have to admit, boggles my mind. They are down there. The children's advocate groups are down there. The 6,500 uninvestigated, now being investigated, child protective services cases, they have the child advocate agencies are down at the legislature today. So there's lots and lots of, now, the thing is, it's first day, these guys are hiding out, or they're gonna be out there, shaking hands. It's the other days, the next 179 days of the Arizona legislative session that, we need to pay attention, to what's going on down there and try to, see if we can get a little more, work on this and other issues. We have another show someday.
We're going to do a show. We're going to have several shows, and I think one of them that Mike wants to do is we're going to talk about Old Town Cottonwood.
Yeah. Speaking of economic,
we're going to do a show on the community colleges.
Community colleges, that's a big one.
So it's been great for you joining us, folks. Sorry about losing my homework on this one, but, you know, the dog ate my computer. been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.